All right, well, our final speaker in this session today is Petra Kalshoven, who's one of our invited speakers to the conference. She's a lecturer in social anthropology at the University of Manchester. She's the author of Crafting the Indian, Knowledge, Desire, and Play in Indianist Reenactment, and is currently examining the skilled imitation of nature that underpins taxidermy in order to shed light on evolving human-animal relations and on conceptions of the lifelike. Today, she will be speaking to us on animal artifacts, categorical trespassing by the curiously lifelike. I'll turn it over to Petra.
Thank you so much, and many thanks to Alexei for the invitation to this wonderful workshop. Thank you. This talk will be about animal objects, stuffed animals, or taxidermy mounts, and how they move between categories. It's a talk about human practices of classification. I want to explore the curious role of these animal artifacts that move between categories, crossing classificatory boundaries. Over the past few years, I've studied the social dynamics behind taxidermy practices from an anthropological perspective, inspired to do so because of a renewed interest in taxidermy as a skilled, possibly artistic endeavor. As part of my fieldwork on the topic, I've interviewed and hung out with taxidermists in the UK and on the European continent. I've become a member of the UK Guild of Taxidermists. I've had some hands-on experience myself, and I have visited many exhibitions in museums and art galleries featuring taxidermy. To begin with, let me give you a mini history of skin arrangement, playing on the etymology of the term taxidermy from the Greek taxis, order or arrangement, and derma, skin. And on the current interest that it attracts in skilled, artistic, and scholarly work. Taxidermy came into its stride with the Age of Enlightenment, discovery and colonization, as strange animals were collected abroad and needed to be preserved in order to make it back to Europe. It gained importance as museums were established in the Victorian age to house natural history collections. Different styles emerged in the Victorian heyday of taxidermy. Just compare this anthropomorphic style by Walter Potter with taxidermy as a scientific and didactic tool displayed in habitat dioramas, where stuffed specimens were artfully displayed in skillful imitations of natural environments. You see some images here from gentlemen's collections turned museums in southern England. After the Second World War, taxidermy experienced a fall from grace. Closely associated with hunting, it came to be considered morally suspect as an example of man dominating nature, and it is of course burdened with colonial history. As embarrassing souvenirs of imperialism and male chauvinism, hunting trophies were left to gather dust in the storage rooms of the Natural History Museum. But over the past decade or so, mounted skins have started to emerge from the closet as curators recognize their potential as narrative tools in post-colonial spaces, for example, in Manchester Museum's New Living Worlds Gallery. In museum environments, a trophy head, for instance, can be reappropriated strategically and performatively to tell stories about all that was wrong about imperialist conquest and all that is wrong about environmental destruction, extinction of species and natural habitats. Preserved animals are increasingly instrumentalized to talk about conservation. They are made to play a role in an ecology of life. Taxidermy has also become fashionable again in private spaces. Trophy heads or Victorian cases with hummingbirds are making a splash in middle-class interiors in London and Brighton as statement taxidermy, sold by young, trendy antiquarians. It is hard to keep up with all the new coffee table books. You can hardly open a quality newspaper without spotting a trophy head or a mention of antlers somewhere. Feathers and wings are making a splendid comeback in fashion as roadkill couture. Traces of taxidermy and bits of animals are apparent all over if you care to look for them. The taxidermized animal then can be considered a node in an assemblage of relations and circulating materials, as has been suggested by human geographer Merle Petchett and artist Kate Foster. In contemporary art, moreover, taxidermy is decidedly in vogue. Damien Hirst's striking use of dead animals in his acclaimed installations plays at 19th century habitat dioramas such as these. Artisans such as American Mark Dion are invited to rummage museum storage areas to fill present-day cabinets of curiosities, seeking to revive a spirit of play that was lost with the rise of scientific classification. Animal mounts are a familiar presence in such contemporary cabinets. Stuffed specimens have successfully crossed over from the Natural History Museum to the Art Gallery. On the wave of this renewed interest in Victoriana, in taxidermy and in former display modes. It is in particular the curiosity cabinet that has become a source of inspiration in gallery exhibits. In fact, of course, we have a cabinet of curiosities right here outside of the building. This sudden renewed popularity of taxidermy seems indeed to be related to a return to curiosity, which is the phrase used by art historian Stephen Bann to describe a trend in museum display that draws on contemporary art interventions. The return to curiosity in art practice, Bann argues, constitutes a reclaiming by the artist of, I quote, realms of knowledge previously relinquished to the scientist, end of quote. Curiosity disturbs a normalized order and positions the displayed object in all its materiality as existing in what he calls a nexus of interrelated meanings. In such an approach, tactile objects, including animal mounts, signal through juxtaposition and hybrid arrangements, leaving it up to visitors to make their own intuitive, wondrous connections, as in an old-fashioned cabinet of curiosities, perhaps. Taxidermy, then, as the quirky, bizarre, perhaps slightly distasteful embodiment of curiosity, can speak to cultures of scientific and artistic knowledge in both a diachronic and a contemporary perspective. Canadian curator Rachel Poliquin discusses how, over the past centuries, people have been projecting their desires onto a variety of genres in taxidermy, according to the fashions and preoccupations in vogue at different points in time. Taxidermy, she writes, is a shapeshifter, easily sliding between categories of objects and between objects and experiences, end of quote. Reflecting on the influx of artists into the realm of taxidermy, she suggests that artists' engagement with the aesthetic of livingness with which taxidermist animals are associated, challenges accepted human-animal relations. Contemporary artists add new dimensions of critique, affect, alienation, and affinity to the mounted animals. And the process of mounting, making taxidermy, and in the process of mounting, shapes shift again. Poliquin conceives of shape-shifting largely as a semiotic process. It is about animal mounts changing meaning or being differently charged with meaning, rather than about mounts actually morphing. I want to take up this idea of taxidermy being a shape-shifter, but rather than focusing on the mounts themselves and their symbolic or sensory potential, I want to think about the taxidermist and the artist's role in making and performing human-animal relations through their actual modeling of specific shapes. Animal mounts may indeed be seen to move into and out of different conceptual categories, from the animate to the inanimate to the reanimated, from living animal to hunting trophy to kitsch to art object, but more interestingly, perhaps, I want to show that mounted animals not only shed light on practices of classification and on entanglements of the symbolic and the material in human boundary making and artifactual trespassing, they also trouble taken for granted distinctions between, for instance, kin and non-kin, nature and culture, and indeed life and non-life. And by paying attention to the making of taxidermy, I suggest we get a richer impression of how they manage to do this. For example, let's return to this return to curiosity for a moment with a Turner Contemporary show in Margate in summer 2013 entitled Curiosity. It featured plenty of taxidermy, including an old overstuffed walrus and a study skin of a king penguin collected on an Ernest Shackleton expedition to Antarctica. The exhibit also included several so-called misfits presented by German artist Thomas Grünfeld, such as this penguin peacock and a sheep dog. Grünfeld produces these hybrid creatures as a comment on human objectification of animals, both in the past, as animals were exhibited stuffed in Victorian times, and in the present, as they are bred and molded as living things to conform to human desires. Now, interestingly, the idea here is Grünfeld's, but these pieces were executed, they were made, by a Dutch taxidermy company, Bouten and Son. It is quite a straightforward example of the way in which some forms of conceptual art work, with the artist coming up with an idea and the craftsman skillfully executing it. It was made actually by Leon Bouten, who does a lot of work for artists and has made several hybrids, misfits, for this artist, Thomas Grünfeld. Bouten and Son work for a wide range of clients, including hunters, natural history museums, and artists. When I asked Leon during a visit to the workshop whether he was prepared to do anything an artist would ask for, he told me, no, he would not take on just any commission. Even in fantasy creatures, the anatomy, he said, must look feasible. His expertise, he said, must shine through in the piece, and anatomy is part of this. He would not do an elephant with a chicken's head, for example. His son, Maurice, an award-winning trophy head sculptor, here you see him at work, told me that his father made the sheepdog misfit for 1,500 euros, and it fetched 45,000 euros when the artist sold it. Animal mounds, then, such as these, are put to work and do work in a discursive and sensory meshwork of contradictory human objectives, as different kinds of practitioners engage with more or less expertly skinned bodies. Professional contemporary practitioners of taxidermy, like Leon and Maurice, claim to be in the business of replicating or emulating nature. It is nature, they say, that shows them how to proceed. Their goal in mounting an animal is to make it look natural, that is, lifelike, even a fantasy creature like the misfits. Taxidermists often associate their practice with a love of nature and a dwelling in nature to observe animal behavior and to become intimate with animal life. It is this living nature that needs to be recaptured. The aesthetics professional taxidermists strive for are those of a nature vivante rather than a nature morte. And yet, the result of taxidermy is at best, of course, nature morte, a still life. There's an interesting tension here between love of nature, a desire to conserve or promote nature, and ideas about what constitutes life and lifelikeness. The articulations between and the attitudes towards these ideas and drives differ amongst practitioners of taxidermy. They differ in particular in relation to these two distinct groups of practitioners. On the one hand, professional taxidermists like Leon and Maurice, on the other, artists such as Grünfeld, using taxidermy in their artwork. These two groups, professionals and artists, tend to have different levels of knowledge and expertise of taxidermy practice. They also tend to differ in terms of the ethics that govern their practice. Many of the artists use taxidermy as a way of expressing a critique of current interspecies relations in Western settings, and they see professional taxidermists as potentially ethically suspect. But at the same time, they covet the professionals' know-how and skill, and they increasingly seek out their expertise, as does Grünfeld in hiring taxidermists to realize his ideas in the flesh. Interesting tensions also occur in terms of ideas about life and non-life. Very schematically, professional taxidermists emphasize life and realistic naturalness in their mounts, while artists using taxidermy tend to emphasize death or hybridity. And you see that brought out, I think, nicely in these three different representations of squirrels. On the top hand right, you see a contemporary professional mount by Mike Gadd of a squirrel, really looking quite lifelike and naturalistic. At the bottom, there's a Victorian anthropomorphic representation. And then at the left, there's an artist's interpretation where you see a squirrel that has just committed suicide. You would think that as a skilled practice of rearranging skin obtained from animal specimens, that is, dead organic materials, taxidermy seems to insert itself rather straightforwardly as a kind of salvage job that aims to turn once alive materials into something resembling life. But things are slightly more complicated than this. Professional taxidermists are very clear about what they do. They seek to breathe life back into dead specimens, and by doing this, they claim to extend the lives of these specimens. Here's a training course going on, anatomy in practice here. A considerable amount of skill goes into this process, not only in terms of stopping putrefaction and decay. Flesh needs to be carefully removed when skinning, both to prevent so-called shrinkage and with an eye on potential future infestations by pests, but also in terms of making the mounts look alive, or at least lifelike. Taxidermists will emphasize that reference materials are vital during the process of sculpting and mounting. These include measurements of the animal's body, drawings and diagrams, photographs of the relevant species, and clues on posture and behavior from field observation. It is the animal's natural posture and behavior that is to be captured through these reference materials. The actual dead body of the animal is said to feature as the best teaching model, as the practitioner sculpts his way back, his work back to the lifelike. Knowledge of anatomy is essential. Professionals express their love of the outdoors and insist on the virtues of field research and anatomical knowledge in their efforts to achieve this lifelikeness. A very obvious resonance, I think, can be felt here with anthropologist Gregory Bateson's cybernetic approach in attempting to understand humanity's role in the universe as a living system. In his book Mind and Nature, Bateson asked, "What pattern connects the crab to the lobster and the orchid to the primrose and all the four of them to me?" End of quote. He wondered, what is it that makes us recognize such things as being or having been alive? Why are we akin? He found clues in morphology and homology, the likeness in structure between parts of different organisms. It is the crab's repetitive articulations that make it appear as something that once lived. Bateson spoke of appendages on living creatures that show rhythmical repetition and that may be compared to similar appendages on a human body. More recently, anthropologist Donna Haraway writes that all critters share a common flesh, laterally, semiotically, and genealogically. Sorry, and this is being podcast. Terrible. Now, Now, in my discussions with professional taxidermists, I have been struck by the bodily analogies that they make between themselves and the animals whose lives they seek to prolong. I found that in particular, bird taxidermists take their own body as point of reference, as reference material, in fact. This is not surprising as such. It is somewhat of a truism that in Western cosmologies, the body is what unites man and animal, and the mind is supposedly what separates them. In taxidermy, however, bodily analogies go further in that these are acted out rather than just assumed to exist. Taxidermists use their own bodies as reference material, both to find their anatomical bearings around the piece they are working on, which can be very confusing when it's turned inside out, and to imagine how the skin would sit if it were animated by a breathing, fleshed-out torso such as their own. Moreover, taxidermists are constantly striking poses, referring to their own body and its appendages, imitating bird posture in particular, and movement, like my gat is doing here. So the imitation that goes on here is not only emulation of nature, of a specific bird captured in a mound, but it is also in the process of creating the mount, an imitation of bird postures and behaviors and even mannerisms on the taxidermist's very own body. There's a kind of choreography of knowledge and memory going on in the attempt to achieve the lifelike. Life is being passed on into something that could be considered non-life, or at least no longer alive, in making it lifelike. This can work in a quite material sense, as the following quote from a workshop in museum taxidermy brings out. It is good, a practitioner said, to preen a bird using your fingers, because your fingers' oil substitutes for the bird's preening oils. So what I've hoped to show in closing is that animal mounts not only move between categories, in their genesis, in the process of their making, they are in motion and they move, they trouble categorizations themselves. And this happens as their makers shift shape in imitating their lost liveliness in bringing about lifelikeness. Lifelessness becomes lifelikeness. And this process of transformation could be argued to be an expression of a form of kin between the animal morphing from inanimate to reanimated and the taxidermist morphing into something bird-like. I'm reminded of Donna Haraway's recent call for interspecies kinovation. Here, the idea of extending kin ties to non-humans. And perhaps ironically, I would like to claim that it is the skilled taxidermist rather than perhaps the artist attempting to convey an environmental message. It's the skilled taxidermist that gets closest to what it means to be alive in kinovating through kinesthetics between his or her own body and the emerging, increasingly lifelike animal artifact. Thank you.